This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face to face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and, of course, on the air right here on 1500 AM, which is, of course, Federal News Radio. 1500 AM, that is. So the U.S. Department of Commerce's National Institute of Standards and Technology, earlier this week, released their preliminary cybersecurity framework. This is to help critical infrastructure owners and operators, quote, reduce cybersecurity risks in industries such as power generation, transportation, telecommunications, you know, the essentials. But this was a long time coming and may very well not answer all of the outstanding questions. Why do I say that? Because I'm looking at a brand new BGov Insight written by senior technology analyst Mr. Sanford Reback. It's called Cybersecurity Framework Leaves Issues Unresolved, and Sandy's with me here now. And before we dive into this particular piece, let's talk about how we got here, because this has been a long road coming.
Absolutely. You know, people have been talking about cybersecurity, at least on the technical side, for probably 20 years. This started to capture the imagination of policymakers a few years ago. And Congress has been unable, some would say, to get its act together. Others would say to successfully pass legislation. Depends on your perspective on this. But in any event, last year in 2012, the Senate was looking at legislation that would have been reasonably comprehensive, but they couldn't get cloture in the Senate. So it never came to a vote on the Senate floor, and obviously wasn't considered in the House. So the Obama administration looked at this and said, Congress isn't doing anything here. We need to step in and do what we can do.
Right. And that was the last thing anybody wanted to happen. He actually signed an executive order saying, make it so, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the last thing that the Obama administration actually wanted. They would have preferred Congress to pass legislation.
Sure.
Typically, businesses like the certainty of legislation a little bit more than they like an executive order, because an executive order in some cases gives the administration a little bit more leeway to kind of do what they want. So I think the Obama administration would have preferred legislation, but there wasn't legislation coming. So they said, okay, we're going to do what we have to do now, because cybersecurity is such an important issue. We can't sit around anymore and wait for things to happen.
So NIST has now released just a couple of days ago their framework, final framework. Before the final framework is published, there is a comment period.
Correct.
It's open at this point. You go on to mention within this that it leaves the framework itself kind of leaves some unresolved questions. Answer that for me. What are those questions that we're talking about?
Well, you know, if you think about it, there are a lot of issues that the framework leaves unresolved. The framework, if you look at it, and it's about a 30-page document, almost is a menu of best practices. Mm-hmm. And NIST basically says companies can go out, and they're all companies in different industries and different situations. They're going to have to decide the right kind of cybersecurity steps that they want to take for themselves. So in that sense, it's almost like a menu. It's not really a mandate, but NIST desperately wants private sector companies to adopt this framework. They'd like this to be embraced by the private sector so they can start building on it. The framework right now doesn't say what it means to adopt it. There's no formal step. You know, does a company come out and say, okay, we're going to abide by the framework? And even if they do that, what does that mean to adopt the framework? Does it mean, is someone going to judge how well they're actually implementing the steps? If they say, yeah, we go through steps, you know, A through Z of the framework, is there going to be anybody who comes, okay, well, you're not really doing step K right. You really need to do it this way. Those kinds of issues of both adoption, which I think they'll solve maybe by the time the final one comes out, and more to the point, implementation, is anyone going to judge this? That's a harder issue because industry doesn't really want a government mandate here. So that's why we're in the kind of voluntary framework to start with.
I was just about to bring that up. This is completely voluntary. So who are they to judge on something that they're volunteering to take up? Can the government actually step in, or can anyone, NIST, anyone step in at that point and go, hey, you're doing steps B through Z wrong. They're supposed to be done like this. Yeah, well, it's voluntary. I don't have to do it that way.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, first of all, there's a question of whether the government actually has the technical expertise to judge whether this is being done properly or not.
I take Exhibit B, for example.
You're prepared
you
today,
see,
aren't you?
As you can see, I was about to bring this up. Continue, and then I'll get on my
So there's one question about whether the government has the technical expertise, which is why, and kudos to NIST here, they have worked very carefully with the private sector. And these are largely private sector driven standards that are in the framework. So this is what the private sector in many cases already does. It's kind of a compilation of best practices. So that, you know, that lends some comfort that maybe they haven't gone completely off the reservation here. I guess another couple points about, you know, about whether this is voluntary versus mandatory. You know, once this final framework comes out in February, let's say that there is a serious cybersecurity attack. We know that's going to could be devastating for the economy, but some people it might not be devastating for are our lawyers, our plaintiff lawyers who go out and try to sue companies for not doing the right things. I think those lawyers are going to look at this and say, okay, you know, there's a federally adopted framework out there. Yeah, it's voluntary, but it's a federal standard that says companies should do that. You didn't do these things. And, you know, maybe through even a process of iterative lawsuits, this thing may become mandatory anyway.
So I'm looking at the disclaimer in the document here, which, by the way, is Improving Critical Infrastructure Cybersecurity Executive Order 13636, Preliminary Cybersecurity Framework. And the disclaimer reads as follows. Any mention of commercial products is for information only. It does not imply NIST recommendations or endorsement, nor does it imply that the products mentioned are necessarily the best available for the purpose. Okay, I get it. They're mentioning things within the document that you could go out and get to voluntarily Yep. go out and get based on their recommendations. They're government mandated recommendations, so to speak. Recommendations that have at this point crashed our healthcare.gov. And as you can see, I'm holding up Exhibit B here, which is a copy of the latest issue of Bloomberg Business Week with a failing to load photograph of President Obama with a spinning wheel, crashed 1 year and one epic fail into his second term. Barack Obama needs a reboot. Now, whether that's, you know, that's Bloomberg Business Week saying that, not yep. Alan Scott. I just want to point that out.
Absolutely.
For information purposes. The government, who, by the way, created healthcare.gov, is advising the general public on standards that they are saying are voluntary at this point. Has anybody else vetted this outside? Have they spoken to Google or any of these other companies that are now involved in fixing healthcare.gov to say, oh, yeah, this is commercially viable?
Well, look, the healthcare problem is a big issue because it looks, I mean, not just because it's crashing and burning.
On the surface, it looks bad. Underneath, we're fine. Don't worry about it.
There. I'm not about to go there and defend that. But one of the problems is that it creates the impression that government can't do anything right.
Ding, 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 ding,
and
ding,
that's,
ding, ding.
That is a big problem. I will say in this voluntary framework, NIST has gone to the private sector throughout the process.
Okay.
They started setting this thing up because of this executive order that came out in February of last year. So they've had four workshops, about to have a fifth workshop. They've got private companies come and testify there. They call on experts. They put, even before they put out this preliminary draft, which there's still time to comment, they put out a draft, preliminary draft in August. So they're taking a lot of comment in. And again, they're not looking to create mandates as much as get the best information they can from the people who really know how to do this, which is largely the private sector. So I think that is a gigantic distinction between healthcare.gov and what NIST is doing here in many ways.
Looks like they did do some due diligence. As I continue to read the press release here, Director Patrick Gallagher, NIST director that is, says the tremendous amount of industry input to this voluntary framework provides, and I quote, a flexible, dynamic approach to matching business needs with improving cybersecurity. So it looks like they did actually do some background work, unlike the president, as I'm holding up Exhibit B again.
If you could hold that closer to the mic so our listeners can see that more clearly.
Take a look at this. It's right here. It's a rather amusing cover and interesting story at the same time about the inability. I mean, I deal with government in my other role here at Bloomberg Government. By the way, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest right now is the gentleman to my left, Mr. Sanford Reback. He's a senior technology analyst with Bloomberg Government, a resume longer than most people's arms, including scholar, Harvard, just the guy's got one of the biggest brains I've ever come across. And he's written Cybersecurity Framework Leaves Issues Unresolved. It's a BGov insight. And we're talking about NIST and such. I deal with people in the government on a daily basis here at Bloomberg Government with computer issues.
Yeah.
Their computers are woefully outdated.
Yeah.
will the government be taking this framework to heart that NIST has now put forward?
Interesting that you should bring that up, because part of the executive order and the other kind of supplementary things that came along with it last February is actually a mandate to the government to get its own act in gear. I mean, I remember back in the olden days, I worked at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, mm-hmm. and we had computers that were woefully insufficient in comparison to what the people coming in to lobby me were using in the private sector. So there is that, you know, whether they'll be doing this with specifically with the framework, they do have a mandate to get their acts in gear. And I think that's, again, credit to them. They've recognized that that's a problem.
It's been a problem for a long time. I mean, when you can get on the phone with someone who's using an operating system that Microsoft has now deemed outdated, and that's the current thing on their computer, there's a problem.
Although keep in mind, you know, this we're talking about deflecting cyber threats. So to the extent that they have old stuff that no one cares about anymore, in some ways that sometimes can be more secure. You know, no one's going after the really old stuff, but that's not what we want to happen here. Obviously, government has a lot of important information as well that we don't want just flying around in cyberspace or to the Russians or to the Chinese or to, you know, rogue states otherwise. So clearly, a lot of work to do there too.
So, what are the next steps in this? NIST has released this framework, preliminary framework.
Yep.
We've got a comment period. Where are we going from there?
So, the comment period goes for until basically mid-December, and then mm-hmm. NIST is going to come out with a so-called final framework. But even NIST has said, "Look, we're coming out with framework, you know, 1.0 in February 2014." Again, to their credit, they say this is going to be a living, breathing document that we want to keep updating going forward. What I think in some ways the more interesting step is going to be is anybody going to adopt this framework? You know, you can think about this, is NIST throwing a party that no one's going to come to? People have to take up this framework. So there is kind of a parallel effort going on to try to figure out incentives to encourage the private sector to adopt the framework. Since we don't have legislation out there saying you must do this, or even not you must do this, you must have some minimal level of protection, which is another way to go, they have to figure out ways to get the private sector to adopt this. So there, the White House and Department of Homeland Security are working on incentives. We're supposed to hear more about that in February as well and in the months thereafter. And that's going to be really important because a lot of this is about cost, you know, and I think the big players in the private sector, they realize that, you know, you work on a stock exchange. We really can't have that go down for long periods of time.
Sure.
You're working in hospitals and other places. They get that. But not everybody is big and has those resources, and all this stuff costs money. So if you're doing a businessman, you're doing a cost-benefit analysis here, you're thinking, okay, chances of a cyber attack on my business, yeah, maybe not too high. Cost of preparing for that, a lot higher. I need to offset those costs in some way, or I need something else to make me want to do this from a business perspective. Otherwise, maybe I'll just take my chances.
Here's the ad campaign that I think that they should use. Adopt our framework. We promise NSA won't learn anything more about you.
Well, what else could they learn, Alan? Right? I mean, I like it. I'm not sure in this.
No.
You know, actually, you bring up another good, all kidding aside, and yeah. You bring up another good point. One of the reasons that legislation hasn't really moved forward in Congress in this year, and probably won't in 2013, is because of all the NSA stuff going on. People on the Hill really want to get their arms around, if they can, what the NSA is doing and maybe reestablish some notion of what privacy actually means in the United States. And until they do that, I don't think we're going to see any kind of cybersecurity legislation. But, you know, one of the incentives that industry wants to adopt the framework is, you know, we're going to be sending information back and forth to the government, to other companies. We don't want people to then turn back and sue us for violating their privacy.
Right.
That kind of incentive would require legislation. We're not going to get that legislation until they figure out how to deal with the NSA stuff. So the NSA has been made for a lot of interesting reading, maybe created a lot of problems, but it's also probably hurt the cybersecurity effort in ways that people maybe haven't thought of as much.
I live next door to several people that work at NSA, and I'm always asking them, so what do you do? What do you, when's my cable bill due? And they claim they don't know.
Well, they're paying more attention to what you do when you're surfing the internet.
That's a good point. What am I thinking? The secrets I'm selling.
Exactly.
That was a joke, by the way. That was a joke. Sanford Reback is his name, but you can call him Sandy. He's a senior technology analyst with Bloomberg Government. The piece is called Cybersecurity Framework Leaves Issues Unresolved. And this is definitely a piece with lots of moving pieces, a target with lots of moving pieces. And I know that you'll keep your finger on them all to keep us up to date.
Well, let's talk about it again. Always happy to.
Lots of defense people out there going, the government is never going to update their computers. Never. Are you kidding? I can't even take my cell phone into a government facility. You think they're going to allow them to get Windows XP Service Pack 3? That's what they're saying right now. I can guarantee you.
I'm sure anyway. That's right.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks, Sandy.
Thanks.
Let me get to something that's been in the news as of late. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel is accusing the U.S. of spying on her via her cell phone. And the president is considering asking your agency to suspend its monitoring of allied leaders. Are we eavesdropping?
There's a great article by the French 24 paper. Tony Todd, I think, did it. 24 Scorsini made a comment that all the nations over there are spying on everybody. I think the most important thing, without directly talking about what we do or will not do in the future, is to say, if Scorsini's comments are right, the real question is, what should we do in the future?
Well, are they right? Is that a yes? Is everybody spying?
Well, that was a question. What was your answer? I would not say that Scorsini's a liar. I think Scorsini is a great person. So I'm not going to accuse him of that. But let me just take this one step further. Partnerships, I think, are very important here, and it goes both ways.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and we talk a lot about spending, government spending and such, but we never really address, at least in great detail, the amount of money truly spent by single companies with regard to lobbying and how they smooth the path to be able to do certain things, I won't say under the radar, but an effort to get people to, say, turn their head slightly while they move this box from point A to point B. Not a gentle way of putting it, I would guess. Well, an interesting article came out by Bloomberg reporter in the Washington Bureau. His name is Todd Shields. It's called Google's Eighth-Ranked Lobbying Machine Takes on Spy Debate. And Todd's here with me now, by the way. How are you?
Hi, good morning.
So this totally struck my fancy because you got two great behemoths in this article. Number one, Northrop Grumman. In our BGov 200, they're at the top. You know, these guys spend a lot of money, get a lot of contracts from the government, and one would think that in doing so much business with the government, they're probably doing a lot of lobbying at the same time, which they are. But Google has taken over, beating them now at this point. How so? How did this happen? Give me the backstory.
Well, they're after different things. Northrop Grumman has to pay a lot of attention to Capitol Hill, which is where a lot of the lobbying takes place, and a lot of attention to the executive branch, but so does Google. Google, as it grows, finds it has an awful lot of interest in D.C., whether it's playing defense against antitrust actions by the Federal Trade Commission. Data use has been scrutinized by the Federal Communications Commission. There's patent legislation now on the Hill. Google has an interest in all these things, and if you have a lot of interest in different places, you need your people to be walking around the city day to day and making sure that you're part of the conversation as Washington grinds, grinds, and grinds.
How much of this is them learning from Microsoft's mistakes?
A lot. The whole tech community in D.C. points to Microsoft's antitrust trouble in the late 90s and says, look, Microsoft didn't come in early and hard in Washington as it developed into a major company. And Google has learned the same lesson. It's grown a lot since the mid 2000s, 2003, 2004, 2005 period, when we were all just becoming aware of it, when Google was just becoming a verb for us all. Now they're big, and they seem to be pretty much part of the circuit now, which is a good thing for them, for protecting their interests.
At this point in time, Google being such a behemoth data collecting organization that has a lot of people's interest, I bet you have a Gmail account. I know I have a Gmail account. Lots of people listening at this point have Gmail accounts and use Google for everything throughout their day. It's probably their primary browser, whether you have a Mac or not. Doesn't matter. Google is a part of everyone's life at this point. NSA and Google two things that have been put in a sentence now for the past couple of weeks as a result of this spying and with the healthcare.gov at the same time. Google is being resourced by the government to help fix their problems at the same time. But I digress. How much of this lobbying money will help them get out of being the whipping boy of NSA, so to speak?
Well, it's not a straight equation. Everybody I talked to for this article made the point that what you're doing is when you spend money lobbying, you're sending people to talk to lawmakers, to lawmakers' aides, to executive branch officials, and you talk early, you talk often. So your point of view is then heard. Now, we can presume Google hasn't told me exactly what they're talking about these days, but from their public statements issued through press releases and interviews, they seem to be very upset about the possibility or the reporting that the NSA has tapped into databases run by Google and Yahoo. This strikes at the core of their business because they need customers or web users to trust them and to dial into their service. Dial in, there's an old-fashioned phrase, but to browse in, shall we say, to their service. So they need to protect themselves from the reputational damage here. And having people who can call the congressional committee aide and say, look, there's legislation moving and let's talk about this part of the legislation, or to even contact the White House potentially. I have no idea if they've contacted the White House. I would assume so. After spending $18 million in lobbying last year, they have somebody who can pick up the phone and get somebody over in the old or new executive office buildings. So you can just call and say, here's our concern. What can we do? Let's get this right.
One would say, looking at Google's past performance, that so far the lobbying is working. I mean, they've already skirted a couple of things in Washington, D.C. The FTC probe back in 2012 and just getting a $25,000 fine, something that probably would have treated Microsoft, had they been in the same shoes, completely differently.
Possibly. But we've got to keep in mind, now Microsoft has grown into Washington and has its own lobbying group here. So many of these tech companies, the big ones, have learned the lesson. They're here and they're represented. Some of them are growing. Twitter, for instance, is growing its lobbying core. Facebook is growing in a significant way. But there still is, some people told me, there still is a Silicon Valley point of view that we're the future, Washington's the past, it's a morass there. Why would you want to get involved with that? Washington, just leave us alone. Well, when you get so big, Washington won't just leave you alone. You'll get involved whether you want to or not. So the smart companies are getting involved on the front end rather than getting dragged into it, kicking and screaming.
These companies are coming in and building up some pretty amazing offices. You tell a story here. Why don't you tell us what Google has going on in their little tiny suite?
Yeah, in their new. Okay. Here's an example, if you will, of how they're growing. In 2008, they moved into offices and talked about what a great party they had. In a blog post. Now they're already moving into a bigger office closer to Capitol Hill. The old office included, this is from their blog post, signature Google touches like a massage chair, lava lamps, I couldn't leave that out of the story, lava lamps, and a game room with naturally Republican and Democratic foosball teams.
Well, of course.
Now, if that doesn't sound Silicon Valley, what does? I hope they have at least that in the new office. And if I were lobbying them personally, I'd say add a bowling lane.
I know that I walk by their offices quite frequently. They used to be on the second floor of a building very close to ours. And looking in the wee hours of the morning, seeing what looked like gigantic palm fronds, like over big chairs and fans, and just an amazing suite of places. And a friend of mine was invited over for lunch, and he was apologized to multiple times because their silverware hadn't arrived yet. They had to eat off of, God forbid, plastic utensils.
Yeah, they're known for their perks, I'll say that, but a lot of companies are these days.
Unbelievable. We're becoming Silicon East, so to speak, as all of these companies are now opening these lobbying shops and growing, learning from Microsoft's mistakes. And I know that you will definitely keep your finger on the pulse of this and update it as it grows.
Yeah, we keep tabs on it.
Yeah, I know you will. His name is Todd Shields. He's a Bloomberg reporter here based in Washington, D.C.'s bureau. Google's eighth-ranked lobbying machine takes on spy debate. Look for it on Bloomberg.com today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And with that, we wrap up this week's edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. We'll catch you again next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.